Okay, we were talking about measuring protein-protein interactions, how you different ways of doing that, and we were talking about a very common one that you're probably mostly familiar with, but I think it's worth going over, and that's Western blotting. And then we'll do one more. And then most of the time today I'll be talking about two papers, one having to do with protein-protein interactions, and one getting into drug development and involves a bunch of different techniques, mostly genetic. So we ended off last time with this schematic Western blotting scheme where you want to see whether you have a particular protein you know what protein you're after, so you have an antibody against that protein. You can pretty much purchase antibodies against almost all human proteins and many mouse and other proteins. So you do an SDS gel first, then you blot it onto nitrocellulose, so you have access to the molecules on the surface of the nitrocellulose or sometimes nylon sheet. And then you take your antibody and you apply it to this sheet, and your antibody will only bind to that band with the, hopefully, with that representing the target protein for which that antibody was raised. And now you have to detect that protein. So you then wash this sheet and apply sort of a developing cocktail, which is going to recognize usually an antibody in general. So that's the only antibody on the sheet is just found to your protein. So you're going to look at a general reagent that will enter, that will look at your antibody. Let's say it's a monoclonal antibody produced in a mouse, so it's a mouse antibody. So this detection I'll talk about in the next slide. So then after that detection, then you only see that band, right? In theory. In reality, you might see other bands that cross-react or as you'll see. So to detect that antibody, which is the black one here binding to your protein of interest in this blue ellipse, you have this general reagent, which is not just an antibody, but it's a fusion protein that has the binding site for, let's say, mouse IgG, specific for mouse IgG, let's say, produced in a rabbit. And that's a fusion protein with a detector enzyme. The most commonly used one is horseradish peroxidase. So horseradish peroxidase, if you supply it with reagents, will catalyze a reaction that will convert a substrate to a product, and a byproduct of that reaction is extra energy released as light. And this is chemiluminescence. So you have this secondary antibody and then this detection of light. The light can be detected either using a camera, or more commonly you just slap a piece of X-ray film on your sheet in a dark room and wrap it up. If you have a lot of signal, you just have to wait 5 minutes and then develop the X-ray film and you see your band. If you have a very weak signal, you can leave it overnight. So between 5 minutes and overnight, of course, if you leave it overnight, you're going to start to see some background coming up. But it gives you an idea of there's a tremendous dynamic range of what you can detect over several orders of magnitude. So that makes this kind of assay much more powerful and flexible than say fluorescence, which is generally only over about one or maybe possibly two orders of magnitude. That is, you could detect a signal of one and a signal of 100 before you're saturating, you just about detect one. And the colorimetric assay, which is even worse, about a factor of 10. So here's a common chemistry that's behind here, which is kind of hard to find. So luminol, it sounds like a nice substrate for luminescence, is this kind of compound here. And in the presence of horseradish peroxidase and hydrogen peroxidase, you oxidize this double N in the ring here, produces nitrogen, and then this compound, which is the dicarboxylic acid, and light, have a certain wavelength. So that's the most common But there are others that are, you know, purported to be more sensitive, and you have companies vying for sensitivity with the PICO assay and the FEMTO assay and the ATO assay, and then claiming to detect smaller and smaller amounts. And so it can be quite sensitive, certainly down in the picogram range of proteins, compared to Kumasi blue, which is probably like the tens of nanograms. So here's a result of an unfortunately rather complicated experiment, but it shows you some actual results instead of schematic. So this is actually a combination using Western to detect the products of a pull-down reaction, which we discussed last time, with the GST enzyme, which binds to glutathione and appropriately labeled proteins. So in this experiment, you have your input, which is, in this case, some protein called SCIP that has, and this is illustrated in a number of the techniques we talked about, instead of having an antibody to SCIP, you have a general antibody in your freezer, which is anti-MYC, and you just make a MYC-tagged SCIP. So MYC is a small transcription factor protein. It's very good antigen. So this alpha generally means anti, when you talk about antibodies. So if you use for your Western blot here, anti-MYC, that's the stuff that you put in. If you just run it through a GST column, then nothing sticks, and you lose your signal. But if the GST column has been bound to this full length, in this case, poly A binding protein number 2, then you see that it's, in addition to pulling down poly A binding protein number 2, it's brought down the SCIP protein that you've put in there labeled with MYC. And so you can detect it here with anti-MYC antibody. And even if you just take the N-terminal domain, so that's a typical kind of experiment, you want to know what part of your protein is doing the binding work. So you take different portions of it. The N-terminal domain also worked, but the part that was the RNA binding domain, I forget exactly what this means, RNA, I should know, something motif, RRMs, I just know them as RRMs, that's the part that binds the RNA. This is poly-A, so it's binding poly-A. And that doesn't have any of the... then it doesn't have the domain anymore that can bind SCIP. And now, to do a separate assay, they do an immunoprecipitation instead of a GST pull-down, this experiment. So here, it's a little more complicated. Up here is what they've done to co-transfect cells to see if this interaction takes place in vivo. So they co-transfect cells with plasmids carrying either the MYC-tagged SCIP gene, that's partner number 2, or the FLAG-tagged poly-A binding protein 2 gene, that's protein number 1. Right? And if they just look at the lysate from these cells, if they transfect just with SCIP, and if they use anti-MYC, which is the tag on SCIP, they get a band. and if they didn't include the BAB, the poly-binding protein tag with FLAG, then the Western developed with the anti-FLAG antibody gives nothing. And the specificity is reversed if they just co-transfect. They just transfect with the poly-binding protein. If they transfect with both, then they see they have both present. So that's just a control that their reagents are working. Now, if they do immunoprecipitation using anti-FLAG, so FLAG is the tag for poly-A binding protein. So they want to know whether SCIP comes down when they immunoprecipitate the poly-A binding protein. So if they just transfect with SCIP and then do for Western blot, anti-MYC. No, I'm not going to be able to do this. So why shouldn't MYC calm them down? Oh, because they immunoprecipitate with FLAG, right? So and they didn't put any of the FLAG protein in. So this is a control. But what's this? So this turns out to be the immunoglobulin heavy chain. Happens to migrate here, and there's so much of these antibody reagents present that often you get cross reaction to the antibody. So this is the heavy chain. Like this is just a strip from a full slab page gel. So the light chain would probably also be present, but be down here. Right? So it happens to migrate right near the flag protein, the polybinding protein. So it's in the wrong place, so it can discount it in this paper. If they put in the polybinding protein, but there's no MYC tagged skip, there might be endogenous skip in this lysate of these cells, but there's no MYC, they didn't transfect with the MYC tagged skip, then they get if they use antibody for the Western blot anti-flag, then of course they see the flag that they put in, but they don't see any skip because they didn't put it in. But now finally, when they put both of them in, they're looking for this evidence for binding. They use anti-flag, they bring down the flag, and they also bring down, by using antibody against MYC skip, they bring down the skip. So skip is binding to polybinding proteins. You have to go through all this, and you'll notice, you know, there's one experiment and there's five controls, which is typical. Right? So that's just simple Western blotting. Right? Something called far Western blotting, less often used. And you can say, avoid the middleman. Don't use these antibodies, primary antibody, and then a secondary antibody. Just make your protein that's a candidate for binding some other protein, and make it in a way that you can detect it. And one way to do that for any protein is to make it radioactive. So you can label it with the strongest radioactivity you can get for a labeling a protein is using sulfur. Sulfur is has both more energy in the particle and it's hotter. That is, it undergoes a more rapid disintegration. I'm not sure if it's more rapid than tritium. I think it is. But C14, for example, is weak because particle is weak, and also it decays very slowly. You use carbon dating, you know, to look back millions of years. But it's still useful, but it's not as useful. S35, I think, has a half-life of 90 days, 30 or 90 days. But it's only in one or two particular amino acids, that's cysteine and methionine. So usually use methionine, because cysteine is a little suspect with that very reactive SH group. It could be sticking to other things. That's my opinion. S35 methionine. So you're going to have radioactively labeled protein. And again, you run this schematic thing. And now you just incubate your nitrocellulose sheet with the radioactive protein, and then give it some time to bind, I don't know, an hour or two. Then you wash it, and then you can dry it, and then slap a piece of X-ray film. And here you can also add enhancers to capture the radioactive particle more efficiently, and you can wait, put it in the freezer and wait overnight or wait a week, and then where your radioactive protein was bound, there'll be a band. And then you correspond, you know, have to know where your protein of interest, the bait here, is on this gel as well. Right. That's this part. So how do you get radioactive protein? That's not so hard. You have a cDNA version of your protein. I should say, you know, in your back here in this complicated explanation, you might take note that I added a few things just a couple hours ago because just doing a last minute preparation, I knew this slide's difficult. I couldn't quite explain it without going back to the paper. And I had to put in some key information, which is missing on your readout, which is that this lower band is in fact the heavy chain of immunoglobulin, that these pluses and minuses at the top reflect co-transfection. I think that's the only changes I made. There's usually a, if you want to get the latest version, which is often just in the afternoon before the lecture, I make last minute changes. You can always, I try to put the date of the last modification on the first slide. So here you clone your cDNA, or in a plasmid, and you clone it right up next to the binding site for T7 polymerase, phage T7 polymerase. That's only about 18 nucleotides. It's a matter of taste how much you use. And so this could be a plasmid, and then you cut open the plasmid, you make a plasmid prep, you cut it open somewhere downstream here near the end of your gene. So you leave your cDNA coding for your protein. The ATG is right here. So you add T7 promoter, and then you add T7 polymerase, and you make RNA. Then you can add to that mixture a translation system. That is, that's commercially available, either made from rabbit reticulocytes or wheat germ, which is early seedling, or E. coli. And you can get any one of these. In the E. coli system, you can even buy these with everything combined. So you can do TNT, transcription. This is what's called from Promega Company, transcription and translation. Or you can make the RNA first try to make a large amount, and then add it to a translation system. It's probably maybe a little cheaper. So the translation system does all this for you. It has ATP, tRNAs, GTP, amino acids, and low amounts of the regular methionine. So the methionine is labeled as 35. And now you let that translate into protein. Now, sometimes these systems have they have other RNA in them because they came from wheat germ or rabbit reticulocytes, so they have the mRNA there. So your mRNAs have to predominate. If you don't want to see any background bands due to the endogenous mRNAs that are in this translation mix, you can destroy them with a calcium-dependent RNase. So you let that run for a little while, destroy the background before you add your RNA, and then you stop it with EGTA, which is specific for calcium and will not sequester magnesium, which is necessary for many other things, necessary for the translation, for example. Then you can run that out on a gel, and you see a band that corresponds to the molecular weight of your protein that's radioactive, so you know you have a good reagent. You might see smaller bands because translation stalled or stopped. You may see other bands because you just can't get rid of everything. But those other bands maybe won't, a few, are not going to be fatal for your experiment, perhaps, because they're from wheat germ and not going to bind to your proteins. But it's better to have a nice band. You can cut out that band and then use it purified. And then just, so that's what's being added here. It's your radioactive protein. Now there's a non-labeling way of detecting protein-protein interactions, quite different from any of these. And I've never used it myself, but I've always wanted to. We don't have one in our department, but there is one in engineering. And that uses surface plasmon resonance. And the most common, there's now maybe five or six such instruments like this. But the first one and the most common one is the Biocor, which is was bought by Roche. GE Healthcare. Anyway, this SPR, surface plasmon resonance, I can tell you somewhat about how it works. I can't tell you about the physics. But basically, You take advantage of a difference in refractive index. You know, if you're underwater and you look up, you just might see silvery stuff. And you can't see out, but if you look at a different angle, you can see through. So at some point, you get total reflection of the light at the interface between two media, like air and glass, or air and water, glass and water, that have quite a big difference in an index of refraction. What this B-accord does, you have a glass plate that's got this thin film of gold, and the gold is there mainly to be able to attach things to it. This gold is good for attachments. And you have a laser, and this is a mirror, but nowadays they use either a prism or a not even sure they use laser, it just might be regular light. Or even a grating, so they can get different wavelengths, and they're a little fancier. But this is how basic mechanism works. If you go in at a certain angle, and you can keep changing this angle, due to the refractive index change between the glass and this is liquid up here, right, you get this reflection business that's dependent on the angle. Again, it's and that angle, where you get the total reflectance, is dependent on the difference in the refractive indices of the glass and what's above it. But it has to be just what's just above it. So it's like that Pacific Biosciences waveguide. It's the same kind of thing. Or total internal reflectance microscopy. You just get an effect just nanometers above the surface. And it doesn't go any further. So if it's just gold, so you have a certain angle. If the gold is dirty, then it changes the refractive index. And the dirtier it is, the more the refractive index changes. But this dirtiness is being controlled by what you put on it. So you can put on your red protein A, protein X, right? And then you want to look at how protein Y, let's just start with whether protein Y binds to it or not. So you get some baseline for this angle. First with the gold, then you put this on, you can get the gold that has an avidin coating on the surface, and then you could have a biotinylated protein, or you can use that'll bind to gold directly. Didn't actually see this being used in the B-accord description, but certainly if you have SH groups like on cysteines, they will also bind to gold just by themselves. So, and then they have a whole chemistry. They have all these. This is like a slide, but it's actually it's got channels, and it's a microfluidic device, really. So you have to buy these, and they'll attach to the gold. You can buy them in different kinds. So you can buy the ones that have a lawn of molecules that have carboxymethyl groups. That's a very reactive group, and then you can react your protein to the carboxymethyl groups by doing a little chemistry on the slide to get this red guy down. Once the red guy's down, then you get some signal for this reflection. So you have a detector here at the other end. And you're constantly moving this back and forth to capture what's the best angle. So angle on this plot here is this, what is that, a theta? A phi maybe. Anyway, and then when you get to the right angle for reflection, you see this, you might say this increase is actually a plot, there's a decrease here in the intensity. So what you're measuring here is this angle. Now you introduce the blue partner, flow it in at a certain rate, you don't need a lot. And if it binds, it's going to increase the refractive index, which is going to change this angle. And so you can detect that binding, that increase in the index of refraction caused by that binding, by noting this scanning mirror, noting how that angle that gives you the maximum reflection changes. What's nice about this method, it doesn't just say, yes, it's binding, but you can see how much is binding. And you're in charge of what concentration, for instance, you put into that flow cell. and you could just flow in a constant concentration of 1 micromolar, and you could see how much that angle changes. The more of these red guys that have blue guys on them, the more the index of refraction is going to change, and so you can quantify how much you're actually binding, how much the red is binding to the blue as a function of concentration, for example. Or, since you're measuring this in real time, as a function of time. So here's an example of an output at both different concentrations and different times. So you're going along and you set the instrument to 0 for just having the immobilized partner here. And then you add the ligand. If you add it at a high concentration, you see this big signal. If you add it at a low concentration, you see this slower binding until at that concentration after, look, this is actually 500 seconds. That's about 5 minutes, right? So after a few minutes, it takes a few minutes to reach a plateau, and you can see what this plateau is. So you can measure this equilibrium concentration indicated by the plateau as a function of concentration and get an affinity to write down the you can write down the KD based on, you know, how much you have to add to get halfway to the full saturation. You see, you add more and more, you saturate it, say, up here. So the KD is be at half the concentration that gives half saturation. So you get the affinity right out of this by doing just a few experiments in a couple of hours. Right? But in addition, you can look at this approach here and measure the half time it takes to reach that. It's a kinetic value, not an equilibrium value. How long it takes, it should be the same, I guess, for all of these, to reach that, to get halfway to that saturation. So that's the on time, half time for reaching the maximum. And you can just wash away the ligand rapidly, just turn another valve, and the ligand adding solution is cut off, and a ligand free buffer of the same composition is put on. And you zip down like this, and you have the off time. So the equilibrium constant is the on time divided by the off time. That's another definition of the equilibrium constant. It's numerically true. And so you can break it down. If you just have the affinity, you don't know whether it's what the balance is between the off time and the on time. But if you have the off time and on time as well, first of all, you have a check that it agrees with the equilibrium value. And also, you have some insight as to what is the limiting factor in how these two components are binding each other. So you don't have to use this. I think that's my last slide. Oh, there's a picture of the machine and some people using the machine. Right. So I got interested in looking at RNA protein interaction, and that can be done too, because it's quite easy to put DNA or RNA, especially for the immobilized part. It's easy to order that RNA that's synthesized commercially with a biotin end on either end, and then you could add your protein mixture and see what binds there. You could do it as a function of temperature, or to see whether secondary structure really is important within some limits. So it's they even had some experiments where they put some DNA down there and then made it double-stranded, and then added DNA polymerase, and then they made it single-stranded. They built it up, and then they added DNA polymerase and a primer, and they could watch the index of refraction increase as the new DNA was synthesized, and they could detect that. And then they could add SDS, and they see the polymerase come off, and the index of refraction drops. And then they could heat it to 80 degrees, and the newly made strand comes off, so they could sort of check that what they thought was happening was happening. So I have a feeling that for nucleic acids, it has not been really exploited as much as it could be. And it's completely, since it's only looking in the very few nanometers, doesn't matter if the solution is turbid or colored, or fluorescent, or whatever. But I'm wondering whether it could be used for like crude extracts, where you have like a mixture of things. I haven't read enough to tell you the answer to that. Okay. Now let's go from one extreme of completely in vitro, well-characterized, measurable binding to an in vivo situation, binding in vivo. And this is an assay that's been sort of pioneered by this guy, Michnik, in Canada. And it has some similarity to the yeast 2 hybrid, but instead of looking, but he's not looking at transcription, rather he's looking at reconstruction of enzyme activity, of a reporter enzyme. And for his reporter, he's using this dihydrofolate reductase enzyme, which is a small enzyme, 21,000 molecular weight, 185 amino acids. And he found that he could, if he made two fragments, first of all, the protein is handy as a reporter because, as we've mentioned earlier, it can be used. There are fluorescent ligands that bind to it very tightly, so you can detect it just by fluorescence in the cell, its physical presence. You can measure its enzyme activity on the spectrophotometer. And you can also use cell survival as an indication of whether the enzyme is present or not, because you can put cells that are lacking this enzyme, as these CHO cells derivatives are lacking this enzyme, they can't survive in one medium, but they can survive in another medium. So they're not dead. You can grow them in a rich medium, but in a in a poor medium, they won't grow unless they have dihydrofolate reductase. So you can look at cell survival. And he used these two fluorometric and cell survival assays in his paper. So the way he uses it then to look for protein-protein interactions, he finds if he cuts this, if he makes as plasmids that only produce fragments, the two halves, let's say, the exactly half of this enzyme, a blue half and a red half, then they don't associate. The chances of association are poor inside the cell, so they have very little activity. They certainly have no activity by themselves, but if they would associate, then they would have this enzyme activity. So he's going to use that association by stimulate that association by attaching his X and Y proteins to these fragments. So he wants to know that this gray and yellow protein, whether they associate or not. If they associate, they will bring with them their little cargo of the two different DHFR fragments, and now you can get the enzymatic reaction to take place. So he unfortunately applies it to a rather complicated situation right off the bat. Okay, but we'll... This is to show the function of DHFR in cellular metabolism that makes it possible to select for cell growth. I think I'll skip this for now because we'll probably hit it the next time in another context. So here's his diagram, and he calls the fragments, DHFR fragments 1, 2, and 3 for some reason. And he's looking not just at protein-protein interaction, but at a protein-protein interaction that is stimulated by a small molecule. It's a rather large small molecule, rapamycin, you see here. And rapamycin is a drug that's used as an immunosuppressant. So it will bring together this, I have all these definitions, and for our purposes, not that important, but I put them all in. That FRB is the FKBP rapamycin binding domain of FRAP. FRAP is the FKB rapamycin associated protein. So there's all these hierarchy of proteins. But basically, these two guys will interact in the presence of rapamycin. As you can see down here, is rapamycin is this hatched ellipse. And when it's there, it's acting as a connector between the two. It makes you think a little bit about like Virginia Cornish's experiments we discussed earlier, in which she was making artificial synthetic small molecule connectors of this time, the methotrexate, again using DHFR, methotrexate and glucocorticoid. Yeah. That you're going to say you're asking if the DHFR could be driving this association. Yeah. Well, they do the control. They don't see. There is always some background, but they don't see significant. They don't see much using these assays. Here's the enzyme assay: dihydrofolate to tetrahydrofolate. If they don't connect these to the two fragments to the the putative associating proteins, and that's their background. They don't see much. We'll see evidence of that. I mean, if that were a major factor, then the whole thing wouldn't work because you just get always positives. So they show here two different assays. One in which if they bring these two together, they make a functional enzyme. They're not measuring, actually. They didn't measure this enzyme in the test tube, but they infer the production of tetrahydrofolate, which is the active form of the cofactor of folate derivatives for biosynthetic pathways, by the fact that the cells, if they put them in a medium that requires that activity, they see no colonies after a week, whereas if they don't add nucleotide, you don't add nucleotides, but you add nucleotide precursors. If they don't add rapamycin, they don't get anything. But if they add rapamycin, they get plenty of colonies. And these colonies, presumably, they have to be making dihydrofolate reductase. Or they can add fluorescent methotrexate. Methotrexate is a tight binding inhibitor of this enzyme. And then now they grow it just in complete medium with nucleotide precursors, and if it comes together, then they should be able to detect this binding. The two fragments alone can't bind. The protein is small, and the substrates are pretty big. It's essentially like one big binding site. So the fragments don't bind either dihydrofolate, the substrate, nor do they bind this analog of dihydrofolate, methotrexate. So the fluorescent derivative, so they can see the fluorescence then in these transfected cells. This is this slide 12 is just more on what these two complicated proteins do, and I don't think that's important for us because we're focusing on the methods. So here's a picture of I think you can see that. Here's a picture of 5 or 10 days with rapamycin. You see the cells are growing after 5 days into little colonies, and they're sort of confluent after 10 days. And without rapamycin, well, there's a little bit. Maybe they doubled or quadrupled, I'm seeing. This looks like it doubled. But then they conk out. And after 10 days, they're dead. So if they count the number of colonies from one of these experiments using a certain number of starting cells, and they put in different concentrations of rapamycin, they get this very nice curve from which they can estimate infer the in vivo KD for the effective dose of rapamycin, which is about 1 nanomolar here, right, to get halfway to maximum on this very physiological kind of assay, cell growth. Here's the assay. Maybe we'll set this off for a minute. Here's the assay using the fluorescent methotrexate. So there is, you see, a background. It's not clear this is a background due to the association of the two fragments. Most cells, especially at this green wavelength, have something called autofluorescence, which gives them a background. You'll see more evidence of that later. And if they add rapamycin, you see the signal goes way up. And here's some of their controls. here's an experimental. They're going into, this is in CHO cells, so it's not something special about CHO cells. They can go into COS cells, which are those cells that have the SV40T antigen, so they can replicate a plasmid containing the SV40 origin of replication, so you get a big signal. Here the background was much higher, and why shouldn't it be? Because these are not DHFR minus cells, these are wild type cells. So here you have a background, a full background, but you can go, because you have so many copies of the replicated plasmid, you get this tremendous signal when you add rapamycin. Here's another positive control, which are leucine zipper proteins. So leucine zippers are known proteins that interact with each other, famously in transcription factors, dimerizing transcription factors. So if they use this as a positive standard, you see that this is, of course, independent of rapamycin. There's nothing to do with rapamycin. So it's present in the presence or in the absence of rapamycin. So that's a nice control. And then if they mix the two, the FRB from the rapamycin partner and the ZIP, which is the leucine zipper from the other, then, of course, those don't associate, so that's a negative control. So this is also a nice assay. They can also measure fluorescence using the cell flow cytometer. So this measures individual cells. So this is thousands of cells describing a curve here. So the number of cells having a certain amount of fluorescence. We'll talk about this in more detail in a minute. Without rapamycin, you have a background. Notice this is a log, which is common, a log of the fluorescence intensity. So the difference between these two is really about the difference between about 3 and 9, so it's about threefold increase. That's what we're looking at here, threefold increase. This is the fluorescent methotrexate in the presence of rapamycin. So you see definitely a shift to the right, but the background is considerable. If you measure the fluorescence intensity in an experiment like this, on a population of thousands of cells as a function of rapamycin, you get actually a different, about a tenfold higher than you got from the cell growth. So I don't know the reason for that, but you're not sure which one is the better indication. This is 10 to the minus 8th molar. The cell selection colony counting technique gave you 10 to the minus 9th. This, in a way, is more direct. And finally, in this first paper, which is around 2000 or so, they show it's not just rapamycin this is good for, but you could do other useful small molecules that will foster the association between two proteins. So here they focus on erythropoietin. So erythropoietin is a peptide hormone, protein hormone made in tiny amounts in the kidney that stimulates red blood cell growth or maturation. So if you're anemic, you get erythropoietin. That would help you, perhaps. It's one of the early recombinant proteins that was produced by Amgen. Before that, it was, as I said, made in tiny amounts. It was very dear and very expensive and hard to get. But now you can make as much as you want as a protein, so it's not hard to get, although I'm sure it's still very expensive. So so one thing that erythropoietin does in getting its... in promoting this growth, one step is to bring together an erythropoietin binding protein 1 and erythropoietin binding protein 2, and it acts to bring them together. So what they thought was that maybe you don't need the whole erythropoietin. You can get away with a peptide you could make synthetically, maybe from a few amino acids, 10 or 20 long. You can make it in large amounts and would be cheaper. So They took this erythropoietin receptor components, binding protein 1 and 2, and attached them to the fragments of DHFR, and then tried a candidate peptide, what do they call it? EMP1, erythropoietin mimetic peptide 1. Now, if they did their fluorescence intensity assay, here it is with no ligand added, that's the background. If they add a real erythropoietin, they can see that they've brought these, they've reconstituted enzyme activity and binding of fluorescent methotrexate. And if they add the peptide, this small peptide instead, they can also get a very nice signal. And then when they quantify it by saying how effective it is, you see that erythropoietin itself, which is these triangles, is very potent. About 3 times 10 to the minus 10th molar gives you half maximal activity. Whereas with this peptide, it's much less effective, 1, 2, 3, 4 orders of magnitude or so. 3 times 10 to the minus 7 compared to 3 times 10 to the minus 10. So 1,000 times less affinity, but you can use a lot of it. And if it's cheap, it would still work. I haven't seen this used. So this is sort of expected. It wouldn't be as good. But so you just, it's still not like you're loading up the person's bloodstream. You still only have to put in about 1 micromolar to get it to be effective. So that's a nice technique. It's called fragment complementation. It's not really been used by a lot of other labs. It has been used by other labs and with other reporters. And I think you can see the analogy to the Yeast-2 hybrid. And here it's in mammalian cells. Now, we talked about detecting fluorescence in single cells, and we have references to FACS, which is the fluorescence-activated cell sorter. So I thought it would be good to show you how it works. So this kind of, if you're just doing analysis, you want to look at how much fluorescence is in this kind of cell or that kind of cell when you treat it with this or that. What you need is a flow cytometer. If you want to take a more active role and not just look, but actually separate cells that have this characteristic or this set of characteristics in terms of the fluorescence they're displaying from the rest of the cells, or maybe 2 different sets of characteristics from the rest of the cells, then there's a machine that will do that, and that's the fluorescence activated cell sorter, FACS. So here you treat the cells in various ways to get fluorescence. Very commonly it's a cell surface antibody, a cell surface antigen, which is a marker for the kind of cell you have. Often the immune system is looked at this way. They have particular cell surface proteins, CD44, CD20, that characterize what kind of a immunocyte they are, this kind of T cell, that kind of B cell. And then you have antibody that's fluorescently labeled that will detect those. Right. So, but you can also look at internal. If you have a ligand that will go inside the cell and make it fluorescent, or if you have a gene that's fused to GFP or YFP or RFP, you can get internal labels as well. So you have this mixture of cells. You introduce it into the machines in a buffer, and you have a laser, and then it's fed through this tubing, and a laser is looking at this tubing, and it's detecting whether the cell has fluorescence or not, or whether the cell is just there. So you have a detector on the other side attached to a computer. And then there's some kind of electrical connection back up here too. When it gets to the end of this tube, there's something that shakes it. So you shake off these little droplets. So these are not the emulsion droplets. These are droplets just in air. So the droplets are small, and you adjust the concentration of the suspension of cells such that most of the droplets do not contain a cell. So that those that do contain a cell, the vast majority just contain 1 cell. But some will contain 2 cells by chance. So you have the empty drops. If there's a since it's known exactly what this rate of formation of these drops is, you can, by some electrical means, zap these droplets and impart either a positive charge or a negative charge. So you have these two possibilities, if you want to. And the computer decides, or what you tell it ahead of time, is that if I see a green cell, I want a positive charge. If I have a red cell, I want a negative charge. And if I don't have a green or a red, then I don't want any charge. As a result, after it goes through this charging, it gets down further in the instrument, and there's these two big plates, which have this big voltage, which is going to attract the negative cells towards this positive plate, and the positive cells towards this negative plate, and so deflect them as they're coming down. The ones that aren't charged just go straight in the middle, throwing those out. But on the right, then, you'll collect all your red cells. On the left, you'll collect all your green cells, and you can go on and then do something with those cells. You don't get a tremendous number of cells. I mean, there's very high, it sounds very high, like thousands a second go through the machine. It sounds like a lot, but if you want to do some biochemistry on these at the end, and you need a million cells, that still takes hours. And you can't run the machine for more than a few hours before you get clogs and things like that. At least that was true when I used it 20 years ago. So, if you're not interested in this bottom part, and you just want to quantify, well, how many red cells did I see up here? How many green cells did I see up here? Then you have a flow cytometer, and that's the more common use. But the cell sorting can be very powerful. And the cells can even be viable after being put through all this insult. So how do we display the data? The simplest way, in a sense, is what we saw before, the number of cells on the y-axis that have a particular type of fluorescence, an amount of fluorescence indicated on the x-axis. You see here on the x-axis, again, it's a log plot. So you're looking at red stained cells, and then no fluorescence added, you always get some kind of background signal. So the blue here is the background signal, but here you can see that the average red guy is about 30, and the average blue guy is about 0.3, so it's about a 100-fold difference here. More information you can get, since you have information about each cell as a dot, as a datum in the computer's memory. So you can say, if you have two colors, well, how much red did this guy have? I'm pointing to here. He only had like one red unit. These are usually arbitrary units, right? Whereas he had, unfortunately, with numbers here, but let's say this is 1, 10, and he had 30 green units. So he had a lot of green units, but very little red units. And so he's over here. And you do this for all the cells, and you see in this experiment how you find these different categories. Most of them have both green and red, so they're over here in the right quadrant. What defines a quadrant? You see, it's not equal here where we put our lines. You're completely in charge of that. So you just set this, and it'll give you how many cells are here and how many cells are there. This is all after you're done. So most of them are have both. Quite a few also have neither. And then there's some that, there's quite a few actually that are green but not red, and a lesser number that are red but not green. That's analysis on two colors. Fancier machines can go up to now, very fancy machines. Very few labs can do this. They go up, I think it's up to 16 colors. Or, I know you get 16 colors, but there's ways to differentiate different labels using tricks. Okay, so now let's go to this paper, which I actually asked you to read. I noticed last night the link was broken. Nobody told me, so I assume you all just got it from yourself, from PubMed. There's another explanation. So this is a paper from Genentech, one of the first. think it might have been the first enzyme, and I think the first recombinant protein made in mammalian cells was this TPA, or tissue plasminogen activator. This is another kidney protein, I think. Again, produced in small amounts. So this is a clot-busting drug, and it's used to dissolve clots if you're having a heart attack, and can be used within hours of your suffering a heart attack and can help you survive it. You go to your emergency room and they can shoot this into you. Before this, they had a similar drug made from bacteria, which they call it streptokinase, which was not had some deficiencies. It wasn't as specific for clots, so it could cause some more damage. But this stuff was superior, and it was a Genentech's, one of Genentech's first major products. So they want to make it. So they cloned it, and they're producing it, and now they want to make a better version, improve on nature for this therapeutic use. And one problem they have is that they inject it, but it's quickly cleared from the bloodstream. So they have to inject it again. It's expensive, of course. And the way it's cleared from the bloodstream is through the liver. And the way it interacts with the liver, first step is that it binds to the hepatocytes, that is the liver cells, the major liver cells, via a domain on the TPA molecule called the Kringle domain. So they had previous research had shown that this is how it binds there. So they thought if they could mutate that Kringle domain, which is actually a domain separate from the catalytic domain of the TPA, if it were possible to alter the Kringle domain so that it didn't bind, or didn't bind so well, to hepatocytes but still maintain most of its catalytic activity, then they'd have a superior protein, a second generation TPA. So that was what they were aiming for. They had to, of course, maintain its enzymatic activity. So I put this in the kind of questions. So what they want to do is introduce a bunch of mutations, not too much, to kill the protein, but sprinkle mutations throughout the Kringle domain, and then screen a large number of these different mutations to find those that have the characteristics that they want. That is, that they have a Kringle domain that can't bind hepatocytes, and they still have activity. So the way they mutagenize, how do they mutagenize it? Well, first of all, how are they going to detect it? What kind of system are they going to do? This kind of experiment, which we're going to be talking about quite a bit, is sort of a major thrust of biotechnology, is to create better proteins. And mutation is a big source of that. And so you have these two problems. You have the mutations, which you can make in various ways. And then you have to identify that one mutation out of 10,000 or 10 million or 1 billion, depending on your resolution, which does the job. So doing the job has to be, it's in the DNA, after all, the mutation, it has to be transcribed, translated into its protein product. And so you need a phenotype. You have to connect phenotype to genotype. If you can make that connection and select for the phenotype that you have, and then look and see what is the genotype that produced that phenotype. And there's many different ways of doing that, and this is one way. So the way they did that is they have a display system where the gene gets into an actual mammalian cell. They were using 293 cells, which is a human cell derived from kidney. And they're going to produce... So they're going to try to put like one mutation. They're looking here for something difficult. They're looking for something that's bad at its job. The job being to get into a liver cell. They want something that can't get into the liver cell anymore. So if they put two genes into this assay system of this 293 cell, and one's fine for binding hepatocytes and the other was what they wanted, it would be masked. It was the one that can bind to the hepatocytes would be dominant. So they want to just introduce as much as possible just single mutant genes into their test cells. This crinkle domain is pretty good size, 300 and about 100 amino acids. And they have this powerful tool. They produced a monoclonal antibody, which reacts, and they made many monoclonal antibodies, but one of their monoclonal antibody, this 387, bounds to the TPA, and when they tested it, they found that it could compete. If they added this, then the TPA would not bind to hepatocytes in the presence of large amounts of this monoclonal antibody 387. So they concluded that the monoclonal 387 must be binding to the Kringle domain and preventing that Kringle domain from binding to the hepatocyte. So they don't have to use the hepatocyte. They can just use this as a surrogate for the ability of the mutated, their various mutant versions. If it can't bind this, they reason, this antibody, which competes with hepatocytes, then it probably won't bind the hepatocytes. That's what they hoped. So they use this, as we've discussed earlier, cassette mutagenesis, sprinkling in mutations in a particular part of the gene for the protein, a cDNA-based gene for the protein. And they did it using error-prone PCR, which is a rather conservative way. They PCR'd just the Kringle 1, the DNA just coding for the Kringle domain as a PCR fragment. And then by engineering the ends of this PCR fragment, they could put it back into the rest of the protein, which they didn't want to mutate because that has the catalytic domain. Now they have to detect this on the surface of the cell. If they're going to use this antibody to see, they're going to look for cells that receive the gene, one of many thousands of genes, that can no longer bind to this antibody. The antibody can't get into the cells, so it's on the surface. So they have to display this engineered mutated TPA with this mutated Kringle region on the surface of the cell. And so they made the whole TPA gene. They put in a tag, which is this DAF, which is, let's forget what that stands for, something accelerating factor. Anyway, it's an anchoring, it's a anchoring the domain of some other protein that that gets secreted just outside and anchors whatever's attached to it to the outside of the membrane. They got this collection of mutants then, of these DAF TPA with mutated Kringle, specifically mutated Kringle region only, connected to DAF. They got it in by electroporation into these cells. And they used 293 cells, but 293 cells carrying, again, this SV40 large T antigen, which should stimulate the replication of any plasma that comes in that has the SV40 origin of a replication, which, of course, they put onto their plasma. So although only once they're electroporating at a low concentration, so on average only one of their mutated population will get into the cell, once it gets into the cell, it should replicate into thousands and produce enough protein on the outside of the cell to be detectable. And they use that using the FACS. They use the FACS to do this. So here's this... the plasma they use, SV40 origin replication. It's got a CMV promoter, a strong promoter. MCS is a multiple cloning site. It's got SV40 poly A site, which is strong. And in this multiple cloning site, they're going to put this DAF fusion protein that they made by PCR. Here's their picture for their scheme then. Mutagenized the cassette just between this region, produced a randomly mutagenized pool for that Kringle region, made all these plasmids as DAF fusion proteins, electroporated into cells, waited 2 days, and then Most of the cells then would have this protein on the outside, right? And then they stain with an antibody just against the TPA in general, not the special antibody, right? No, this would be the special antibody. So they stain it with a fluorescent derivative of that antibody that's specifically against the Kringle region and is simulating the receptors of the hepatoma cells. So they're going to sort the cells now and look for those with low fluorescence. Just very courageous, because it could be low, cells could be sick. Lots of reasons you can get a negative result. But it worked, right? Otherwise we wouldn't be talking about it. Once they separated these cells that had the low fluorescence, they did what's called a HERT extraction. That's not an acronym, that's Professor HERT, who in the 60s devised this way. It's sort of like a plasmid prep from cells, that you break open the cells kind of gently, and the nuclei with detergents, and you treat it very gently so the chromosomal DNA, which is large, kind of all coagulates. If you spin it down, then you can actually get a pellet of chromatin, maybe not chromatin, but of DNA, which is like this soft, viscous pellet on the bottom of the tube. And in the supernatant, the circular plasmids didn't participate in this whole forming of this knot on the bottom of the cell. And you enrich for the free circles using this HERT extraction, at least in theory. We're having a lot of trouble getting it to work right now in our lab. I said all this. Then they take these circles and they actually resort it in the FACS again. And then after two rounds, they clone it in E. coli, pick a clone, which purifies, of course, as well as amplifies, purifies the individual plasmids. And they got this very nice result, 60% of what they did by binding negative. And here's some of the results in the form that we talked about a minute ago. So over here on the x-axis is the binding to that antibody that's simulating the hepatocyte. So you want something that's low here, right? And over here they use an antibody with a different fluorescent label, fluorescein. This is phycoerythrin, which is one color. Fluorescein is another color. And this is looking for other parts of the molecule, not the Kringle domain. So they want something that's high over here, but low, high on the y-axis, but low on the x-axis. And you see in the first sort, they have some candidates here. Mostly, you see this diagonal, that's could be due to the fact that cells are of various size, so you'll get bigger signal of everything. If there's no particular bias one way or the other, the bigger cells will have both colors higher and smaller cells less. Or there could be a cell that's just not producing as much for whatever reason of of this protein. So whether you look at it with this antibody or that antibody, it's just proportional. So you expect this diagonal, right? So they take these cells at the past sort 1 and they put it into sort 2, and indeed it's enriched in sort 2. They must use a lot of cells here. Cells that were just mock transfected didn't make any TPA, just gave this background down here, low on both. Now they took one of their clones, and their clone here just pretty much gave this diagonal line. You consider this a negative result, no good. But look at clone 2. Now they're looking at specific proteins, right? Not just this mixture. Clone 2 is just what they were looking for. You have, of course, a background of even those non-transfected cells, right? And you have a lot of cells, the majority of the cells that have indeed this high TPA from 372 have very low, just background levels of this Kringle antigen as detected by the monoclonal antibody 387. There's another good one, and another good one, and another good one. Said all that. Notice these are log plots. Log plots. So now they want to test for hepatoma cell binding. So they actually they label, to make it easier, they label the wild type TPA with fluorescein. So now the TPA is labeled with fluorescein and not the antibody. This is the protein itself. It's chemical conjugation of fluorescein. Fluorescein isothiocyanate, very reactive. And then look at the at this binding using the cell sorter. What they see is if they add more and more of this fluorescein labeled TPA, this is nanomolar, and look at the fluorescence, which is the part that's bound to the, this is accounts the intensity of the fluorescent signal from the cell flow cytometer in this case, and not using it to separate cells, they get this total. Then they do a control to look for the specificity of this binding by adding like thousandfold excess of unlabeled TPA. So that should displace the labeled TPA by a thousandfold if it's specific binding. So you should essentially eliminate it. However, if it's just binding to some extent all over the cell, then the hepatoma cell, then that's background. And indeed, they have a high background here, about, let's say, a quarter of the signal, so that this signal decreases if they add, so they essentially subtract the signal they get in an experiment where they had essentially displaced all of their labeled TPA from when they just use the labeled TPA. And the difference is the specific binding. This is a common procedure you go through if you're looking at specific binding, to try to compete it out. We saw it, for instance, before in the EMSA assays for binding of DNA to protein. So, now they look, their assay is to use the mutant TPA to see if it can compete with the wild type TPA for binding to hepatocytes. If it competes well, then it's no good because it's still got the ability to bind. So these guys are no good. This is no competitor. If they put in a competitor, it competed with it. So that's no good. But these guys, so they're still binding. In other words, if they can compete with the wild type signals, see, they do it this way so they don't have to label. It's hard to label these proteins with fluorescein, so that they only have to label the wild type, and they use all the different mutants to see how they can compete with that. So these guys couldn't compete at all. So that's a good result. And then they also produce that protein in cells and measure the enzyme activity, its inability to lyse clots. And some of them were no good at that, but most of them were just fine. I don't see a wild type control here, but no, it's percent of control, actually. That doesn't make sense. It was only 1%. The control must be something else. But so some of them failed this test, but most of them actually passed this test. And so if they look at all their isolates, they had some that had poor binding, minus, and clot lysis, yes. Minus, yes. Plus, minus, plus. Those were the good ones. And they could see what amino acid had changed by sequencing the DNA. They had a whole bunch of good candidates. They look at the at where these amino acids are in the structure of the protein. They see they're in this, in fact, Kringle domain, as they're expected to be. And so they're affecting this. So in this way, they got a bit good second generation to go. I don't know what generation they're up to now. This is 1999 or 1992, you know. But you see how they use just a whole panoply of tools to get, and the basic strategy of making a lot of genotypes and isolating the phenotype they wanted. So I always love to talk about this paper. Okay, we'll start a section on mammalian cell genetics next time.